the headlines this hour. Iran says Washington's noncompliance with its obligations is the main threat to any agreements in the Vienna talks. Canada's Prime Minister declaring a state of emergency to end the trucker-led protests that started in Ottawa but spread to blockade border crossings with the U.S. And a human rights group accuses Myanmar's military of committing war crimes in an eastern state by killing civilians and using them as human shields. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's top security official calls the proven U.S. noncompliance the most significant threat to any agreement, as talks on the revival of the 2015 Iran deal are underway in Austria's capital. Ali Shamkhani says verification and guarantees, the two main demands set out by Iran, are the integral part of a good agreement. In a tweet posted hours ago, he noted that the real removal of sanctions means that Iran would enjoy reliable and sustainable economic benefits. Back in 2018, the U.S. unilaterally pulled out of the Iran deal and brought back the sanctions. Now Iran and the remaining signatories are engaged in intensive negotiations to restore the agreement. Earlier, Iran's foreign minister spoke with his British counterpart over the phone and urged all parties to show seriousness in the ongoing talks. Hossein Amir Abdollahian added that the recent progress made is due to the logical approach Tehran has adopted. Meanwhile, China, also a party to the deal, has called the U.S. the culprit in the ongoing standoff and urged Washington to take active measures to resolve the remaining issues in the earliest possible time. Iran's deputy ambassador to the United Nations says unilateral sanctions against her country amount to crimes against humanity. Zahra Ershadi denounced the sanctions on medication and humanitarian goods. She said that a lot of Iranian children have lost their lives due to drug shortages caused by such inhumane bans. The Iranian envoy stressed that countries which impose sanctions on other nations should not go unpunished. Ershadi emphasized that her country demands an immediate halt to all coercive measures, including imposing sanctions. She said a removal of sanctions on Iran can provide the country with guarantees for achieving economic and social development. The U.S. has imposed illegal sanctions against Iran with the aim of crippling its economy. It further stepped up the bans after unilaterally withdrawing from the 2015 deal. We've spoken to University Professor Fouad Azadi to get his thoughts on the unilateral sanctions against Iran. He believes international human rights organizations need to step in and show their opposition to this illegal act.
Iran is used to this type of illegal behavior, and it's time for international human rights organizations to seriously oppose this criminal behavior that the U.S. has been engaging for many, many years.
Palestinians rally in the blockaded Gaza Strip to voice support for administrative detainees in Israeli jails. Administrative detainees are denied due process in Israeli custody, and their detention orders can be renewed indefinitely. Bishop Shannon brings us more in this report from Gaza.
People from all walks of life held a rally Monday in front of the Red Cross office in Gaza to support Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. They protested Tel Aviv's inhumane treatment of thousands of Palestinian political prisoners, especially those held under administrative detention. The event is part of a week-long national campaign in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners. This, as Palestinian prisoners observed a one-day hunger strike on Monday in all Israeli prisons.
We are here to send a message of solidarity to administrative detainees and to all the prisoners. We will not let the prisoners down, and we will spare no effort to release them. We also call on all international agencies to stop Israeli crimes against Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are denied basic rights. Last month alone, Israeli regime forces arrested 504 Palestinians, including 50 children.
We are here to call on Palestinian resistance factions to support the prisoners and exert pressure on the Zionist regime to release them. Our enemy doesn't want peace and only understands the language of force and the language of armed resistance.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world turns a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
Administrative detainees are currently boycotting Israeli courts because their detention is illegal. They are being held under secret evidence under inhumane conditions. Administrative detention is an Israeli policy to make prisoners suffer.
Palestinian administrative detainees are being held without charge or trial, while their incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely.
Currently, the Israeli regime keeps more than 500 Palestinian prisoners under administrative detention, including women and minors. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Syria calls on the international community to help stop Israel's atrocities in the city of Al-Quds, says the regime's brutal practices amount to crimes against humanity. A statement by Syria's foreign ministry urged the world to work to prevent further killings of Palestinians and more violations of their rights. The statement described Israel's attempts to displace Palestinians and seize their properties in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Al-Quds as crimes against humanity. The area has been a source of tensions over the planned eviction of Palestinian families there and demolition of their homes. On Sunday, Israeli forces and settlers attacked Palestinians protesting the establishment of a parliamentary office by an Israeli lawmaker there. The violence left 30 Palestinians injured. Regime forces remain heavily deployed in the neighborhood.
Another bloody day has been witnessed in the occupied West Bank, this time in Jenin. 17-year-old Palestinian teen Mohammed Abu Salah was killed in the village of Silat al-Harithiya as Israeli troops raided the town on Sunday night to demolish the home of Palestinian prisoner Mahmoud Jaradat. Dozens of Palestinians were injured by live ammunition and rubber bullets fired by the Israeli forces towards the protesters who rushed to the area to prevent the demolition. Mahmoud Jaradat is a prisoner accused of carrying out shooting last December that led to the killing of an Israeli settler near the illegal settlement of Homish.
What my dad did is a heroic act. It's a very sad and painful feeling to see our home destroyed, but we don't want to show the Israelis that we are sad. We can rebuild the home.
The Israeli forces raided the village and immediately opened fire at the protesters because youths gathered to protest the demolition. A number of them were wounded and one was killed while defending Jaradat's home. And after a few hours, the Israeli soldiers blew up the house with dynamite.
Tension continues to remain high for the third consecutive day in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. Clashes have been breaking out between Palestinian residents of the neighborhood and Israeli settlers and soldiers. Paramedics say over 30 Palestinians have been injured. A dozen others were also detained. The clashes came shortly after Israeli far-right Knesset member Itamar Ben-Gavir announced that he would be setting up an office in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood to protect the settlers. Ben-Gavir had erected a tent in the front yard of Salem family home, another family in Sheikh Jarrah facing imminent expulsion.
The Israeli extremist Knesset member is leading a campaign to allow settlers to take over Palestinian homes in Sheikh Jarrah. The Israeli regime is giving him full support, while Palestinians are defending their presence in Sheikh Jarrah and resisting the Israeli project to wipe out their existence.
Several Palestinian families in Sheikh Jarrah face potential eviction by settler organizations, all following last year's tensions and the May war between the Israeli regime and armed groups in the Gaza Strip. Observers today warned that Israel's continued aggression against Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and its escalating violence across the occupied territories could be the spark that sets the entire region ablaze. Because at the end of the day, Palestinians say they will remain steadfast and Tel Aviv's violence will not stop them from defending their rights. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Palestinian resistance movements condemned the Israeli Prime Minister's visit to Bahrain. The Hamas spokesman, Fawzi Barhoum, said such visits can never legitimize the regime's occupation of Palestinian lands. Barhoum held Bennett responsible for the atrocities that Israeli forces commit against Palestinian people. Also, the Islamic Jihad movement has strongly condemned Bahrain for hosting the Israeli Prime Minister, saying that such trips bring nothing but threat and danger to Arab states. Bennett arrived in Manama on Monday and will meet Bahrain's Crown Prince and Prime Minister during his two-day stay in the country. Meanwhile, hundreds of people rallied in Manama to voice solidarity with Palestinians and denounce Bennett's visit, which coincides with the anniversary of their 2011 uprising against the Al-Khalifa regime. Bahraini political activists in Iran have held a presser to highlight the atrocities of the Bahraini royal family against its people. press conference comes on the anniversary of Bahrain's 2011 uprising against the ruling Al-Khalifa dynasty. Yusuf Jalali reports.
As Bahrainis are marking the 11th anniversary of the February 14th uprising against the ruling Al-Khalifa regime, Bahraini rights activists in Iran are calling on their people to stay steadfast in their struggle against the regime's unjust policies.
We will never give up, and we will continue our fight for freedom and for the constitution that our nation can write that with his hand, with his people who are free, and they would like to be free forever.
Since February 2011, Bahrain has been the scene of pro-democracy protests by Bahrainis who complain about discrimination in the Persian Gulf Kingdom. The Bahraini regime has since been clamping down on any sign of dissent and has imprisoned and executed a large number of protesters. In a televised speech aired from Iran's city of Qom, Bahrain's prominent Shia cleric, Grand Ayatollah Sheikh Isa Qassem, called for the establishment of a democratic and constitutional system to replace the Al-Khalifa dynasty.
There is no solution to the ongoing political crisis in Bahrain in the absence of a democratic constitution. The ruling Al-Khalifa regime's insistence on the policy of injustice will only open up rifts and create deep social divisions. Bahrain must be set free from the shackles of oppression.
Activists here also slammed Al-Khalifa for normalizing its ties with Israel, saying the move shows that the regime has no respect for the ideology of its people. The Bahraini rights activists say Al-Khalifa and Al-Saud are the puppets of Israel and the U.S., serving their interests in the region.
Bahrain is entering a critical stage and is turning into another Palestine. Israel is increasing its influence on the subordinate Al-Khalifa regime and is seeking to build military bases in Bahrain. This is a serious threat to the entire region, including Iran.
Bahraini activists argue that without Israeli and American support, the autocratic regimes in Bahrain and Saudi Arabia would collapse in a few days.
Political activists here say Al-Khalifa's brutal crackdown on dissent is a proof of their illegitimacy to rule the country. They say the revolution will not subside until the Bahraini royal family relinquish power on the grounds that it does not represent the majority of Bahrainis. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Canadian Prime Minister invokes rarely used emergency powers to end prolonged protests against COVID restrictions that have shut down some border crossings and paralyzed parts of the capital. Justin Trudeau says that he cannot allow the blockades to continue as they are harming Canada's economy and endangering public safety. The powers allow the federal government to override the provinces and authorize special measures to protect security during national emergencies. This comes amid growing frustration over what critics see as a permissive approach by police to demonstrations in some areas. The protests started by Canadian truckers opposing obligatory vaccination for cross-border travels. The movement has turned into a rallying point for people opposing various policies of Trudeau's government. The Canadian Parliament has 7 days to decide whether to approve the use of emergency measures. 4 provinces have already opposed the plan, saying it is unnecessary. Human rights groups are accusing Myanmar's military of committing a series of atrocities in the eastern state of Kareni that may constitute war crimes. Fortified Rights says troops have massacred civilians and used them as human shields while attacking churches, homes, and camps for displaced people in the Flashpoint state. The group says that its evidence shows at least 60 civilians have been killed in Kareni since May, when the military began a crackdown on local ethnic militias. The fighting has forced nearly 180,000 people, more than half of the state's population, to flee to safety. 2 other groups also say soldiers burned some 40 villagers alive in their vehicles on Christmas Eve. They are now calling on regional nations to impose an arms embargo on Myanmar's junta over the crimes. The army seized power last February following a coup d'etat. Campaigning formally begins in South Korea for a presidential election dominated by political scandals. 14 candidates are running for president in the vote planned for the 9th of March. It is expected to be the tightest race in 2 decades between the ruling Democratic Party and the main opposition People Power Party. Polls show that they are neck and neck, but the prospects are being undermined by repeated scandals, including the abuse of power by incumbent and former officials. Polls show that fighting corruption is a top priority for Korean voters when choosing the next person who will rule the country. Our correspondent in Seoul, Jennifer Chang, tells us more about the candidates in South Korea's presidential election and some of the scandals that the two main rivals are involved in.
There are a huge number of controversies surrounding the candidates, and they are extremely opposite from one another. One is a progressive who favors engaging North Korea. The other is a conservative who is pro-U.S. and is in favor of considering even a preemptive strike on North Korea if it is determined that the North is about to attack South Korea with, say, a hypersonic missile. So these two candidates could not be more different, and they are running neck and neck, which shows you the polarized atmosphere. This election is being called the negative election because both candidates are controversial. The Democratic Party candidate, who is a progressive, Lee Jae-myung, is accused of letting his wife use his corporate credit card when he was the governor of Gyeonggi Province and misappropriating government funds for small purchases. And the conservative candidate, the pro-U.S. candidate Yoon Suk-yeol, has a wife who is equally unpopular because she's accused of falsifying her resume when applying for teaching jobs. He is also accused of relying on his wife's shaman. Well, voters, they are not so interested in North Korea's missile tests. North Koreans are their brothers, as far as they're concerned. They're more interested about their livelihoods, about the deepening inequality here in South Korea, which is Asia's fourth largest economy.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
Does it matter who owns English football clubs? Police are investigating a graphic banner displayed by Crystal Palace fans that targeted the Saudi Arabian takeover of Newcastle United. That banner focused on the Premier League's ownership test following Newcastle United's £305 million sale. It featured illustrations of a man dressed in Arabic clothing, alongside what appears to be chief executive of the Premier League, Richard Masters. The sign listed offences the regime is accused of by human rights groups: terrorism, beheading, civil rights abuses, murder, censorship and persecution, which were all ticked off on a clipboard under the heading Premier League Owners Test. The Premier League's chief executive, Richard Masters, was also depicted giving a thumbs up to a bag of cash, standing in a pool of blood. Palace fan group Homesdale Fanatics has said it created the banner, which was shown during a recent football match. An accompanying statement said, "To give the thumbs up to this deal at a time when the Premier League is promoting inclusive initiatives shows the total hypocrisy at play and demonstrates the league's soulless agenda where profits trump all." Although the Premier League said it had received legal assurances from the new owners that the Saudi state would not control Newcastle United and there would be penalties if this is not true, others doubt this to be the case. While the impact of these huge investments has been league success, for example for Manchester City, thanks to Abu Dhabi investment money, there are claims that these massive money ventures are designed to create a positive impact for the image of wealthy Middle East dictators. What does the public think of Saudi ownership of English football clubs? And why are these states so eager to buy British clubs in this way? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. What does the public here in North London make of Saudi Arabia's human rights record? And do they even care? That's what we asked. Here's what they said.
I've not heard anything about, I've heard of Saudi Arabia, but I know nothing about that.
I'm not an expert, but from what I've heard, at least on the women's rights side of things, it's pretty poor. It's pretty poor. Like listening to the news, I think probably they're taking small steps to, I guess, like as a kind of show to like, oh, look, we're doing this, but in reality, it's not good.
To be honest, I don't actually know a lot about that. That's something that hasn't really come up on my radar. I haven't got a clue, to be honest. I really don't have anything to say about that.
I mean, the thing about Saudi Arabia is they obviously have made some changes, things like, you know, the last few years, women being able to drive, other things, but there's a lot that still continues to be sort of hidden and under the surface, and some of their arms deals, for example, with Yemen and other things, you know, there are clearly a lot of things going on, not all of which, I mean, most things don't make the news and most things aren't very public, so.
I just know that it's appalling, yes, that's all.
I can't say I've ever actually thought about it. Maybe I should. And probably after this interview, I'll go on my phone and do some Googling.
Not a good record. I've supported Amnesty International for many years, written quite a few letters about Saudi Arabia's record on this subject. So, no.
I'm concerned about it. Well, because it's not very good, as I understand it. I don't know enough about it to go into detail, but yeah. So, yes, I am concerned about it.
I think it's poor, and I think giving them the opportunity to use the Premier League to kind of wash it out is a bad thing.
I wouldn't say that I'm, you know, terribly knowledgeable about it, but I know that they have the death penalty, and not much else. I know that their sort of leader was accused of the murder of a journalist recently, and that's about all. I don't think they've got great rights for women, would be my impression. But I'm not an expert on it at all.
No, at all. Yeah, not at all. Saudi Arabia is good country. It's a Muslim country and it's good. And I don't know, I never heard any problem in Saudi Arabia. They're good, yeah.
I care about it because where I'm from as well, because I wasn't born here. So I'm in that part of the world where it's money talks, isn't it? That's all it is, it's just money. You know, I don't think they should be there anyway, to tell you the truth. Well, what should they?
What does the public think of Saudi-related state interests purchasing Newcastle United Football Club?
I mean, I think in general it's just sad how, you know, rich owners are just, you know, buying clubs. It feels like there's not really that closeness with fans anymore. You know, they're just they're different, just in a world of their own, just buying success. And yeah, I think that is sad,
Yeah, I mean, sometimes people say that sport shouldn't be political, but I think that's a, you know, they're making a quite a big statement. I think they've also owned quite a lot of other property and other things, don't they? It's not just the football club, various things that they own. And yeah, I don't really know what it's about, but I suppose it's having, you know, gaining influence in various different countries and making agreements in order to make better trade deals, and a lot of it's about arms as well. So, yeah, it's not great.
I'm a huge football fan. I'm obviously a Gooner because of the area I live in. I kind of sort of disagree with the amount of money in football in general. I think it should be a bit more like fantasy football, where you have a certain amount of money that's capped and each team then has a set amount of money, because then it's fair. And then also the game is not about just the players, it's back about the sport. Whereas at the moment I feel like football is now just about how much money can one team spend on one player, and it becomes about an individual contest instead of the team sport. So I think, you know, I don't think there's a problem with like Saudi Arabia or other kind of countries buying up football, because it's a global sport and it kind of spreads awareness of the Premier League and stuff. But I sort of disagree with the whole money aspect of the sport, really.
I haven't got very strong feelings about it. I'm aware of it and worried about, you know, a country like Saudi Arabia infiltrating our sport. But, you know, sport is business, is money, isn't it? I mean, football is capitalism with a capital C, really, isn't it? So, yeah, I mean, sad but true.
I think it's gross. Like, and I think if you look at the amount of dirty money that's in UK politics and UK sport, especially football, it's not a good thing.
I'm a football fan myself. It's a bit tragic how they bought Newcastle Football Club. Surely Newcastle fans will disagree with me. If they look at their track record, I think it's quite concerning.
Well, they have money. That's why they bought that big team. Yeah, that's good. That's good. They get money for that.
I guess it's a bit of a kick in the teeth. But I mean, I believe in like trade between different countries, and I don't believe in Brexit. So I'm not like in favour of not trading with other countries.
I think it's just dirty business of Saudi sheikhs, like let's say this, and it. Canberra-related money laundry or something like that. In my opinion, I think this. And as you know, that the papers, Pandora Papers, is maybe it's just related each other's.
I don't particularly like the fact that all the Premiership football clubs are owned now, you know, by people who seem to run them for profit rather than, you know, sort of the true fan base. So slightly disapproving view from that point of view. Obviously, from what you were touching on, their human rights record, that rings alarm bells as well. So overall, not a fan, like, you know, I guess.
I mean, as long as it keeps the clubs running, I guess. That's quite good, I think. I'm not a pro, to be fair. But I think that could be great.
Deep down, I'm not really bothered, but it shouldn't be them, you know, because they're taking over. Not in a bad way, I don't mean in a bad way, but it shows you money talks. It's all about money. He sold it for 300,000, 300 million, and look how much they're going to invest. But the fans want it, you know, and that's it. It shows you at Crystal Palace with the banner, all the things they've done. They've highlighted it, didn't they? You know, that's it, really. I mean, I don't know what else. What else do you want to know?
Football commentator Gary Neville has argued that Saudi Arabia's ownership of a British football club means that they're more likely to listen to human rights concerns and that this could lead to an improvement in their human rights record. Does the public agree?
There's too much money in football to think that people would discover a conscience.
Not actually, because it's different things, yeah. But it can be some illegal things, I believe, because it's not easy to prove the source of money.
I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not really sure. Because obviously my life is completely different from these people who are able to financially buy a football club. So I wouldn't... It's not the same life, I would say.
I don't know. Their human rights is bad. So at the end of the day, I'm not the one who makes a decision. You know, the FA should know better and the Premier should know better. But they must have went for it, didn't they? You know, the Premiership allowed it, you know. But they don't really care either. Brings money into the Premiership, doesn't it?
I think you have to respect Gary Neville, who knows his football. I think sport has can have an impact on politics and for the good, but it's a bit of a tall order, isn't it?
I mean, I think it's wishful thinking. I don't think they're going to change the way that they treat people in that country because they bought Newcastle United. I don't see that happening.
I don't think it's going to make a difference. I mean, this is like a bit of fun for them, a bit of petty cash. I don't think buying a football team here is going to make any difference to human rights in Saudi Arabia.
I think the FA should have made a private inquiry about the takeover as well, the background of it, really. But it's sad that not many English-owning football clubs around the Premier League. And I think the FA should act upon it. And I think Phil Neville, honestly, should keep his comment to himself.
Well, who knows? Saudi Arabia is bad. I don't know. We're just people talk. Says that bad, good. I don't think so. That is a businessman who buy the. It's not about good country or not.
No, I wouldn't follow that school of thought. I like Gary Neville. Like, he's quite funny, but no, I don't think I would agree with him on that.
Completely different thing. I mean, it's the same with in many different countries where you hope that having some influence over human rights for being investing in that country or developing that country, but actually it doesn't work out like that. Yeah, no, I don't believe that argument.
On first thought, no. I think that seems a little bit optimistic. I think that the fact that they've bought a club, frankly, won't make a difference to that.
A quick look at the financial statistics tells the story. The Newcastle United deal cost its new Saudi owners £305 million. However, the money invested in just the players in Manchester City is estimated at over £1 billion. It's also estimated that 13 football clubs out of 20 in the Premier League are now wholly or mainly foreign-owned. The net worth of the Newcastle United owners is put at $250 billion. In recent years, we've seen Saudi Arabia host British elite boxing matches, and now they've purchased a British football club. What, in the public's opinion, is behind Saudi Arabia's sudden interest in British sports?
Well, I think it goes back to, like, you know, it's about the reputation. If they can get these massive fights the whole world's watching, you know, if they can get AJ, Usyk, Fury, it just seems like that's the place to be. There's some kind of, you know, reputation, some standard there, which obviously there isn't, but that's what the money's buying, and it's a shame these sportsmen are going off and buying into it. So I think that's the main thing, it's a spectacle, getting an audience, a viewership there, making it seem like, you know, it's a place to be, but it's just money, and it comes back to money.
I guess if I had to say something off the top of my head, it's like I said earlier, where sport is a very big part of what we do. I mean, I live in Highbury and Islington. I've lived here all my life, and I've watched, like, Arsenal matches and people streaming out of Hunt, like, thousands and thousands of people, you know, streaming out of Highbury Islington Station, walking down Highbury Fields to go see a sports match. And so if you think about it, the perhaps reach that you could get by affecting sports matches is pretty big.
I guess England has always, and Great Britain, because we're such an old nation, we have a lot of history here. And I definitely feel that a lot of countries like to buy in to the things that we have here in Great Britain because of, like, our ancient theatre, our ancient sport, architecture, all that sort of stuff. So I feel like Saudi Arabia and other countries do like to invest in Great Britain. It makes them feel like maybe that they have more of a historical background or backing behind them. Whereas in, if you're a relatively new country, development-wise, you sort of don't have that richness that we have here, I think, in more of a cultural aspect of richness, not as in, like, actual richness.
I do believe it's a business warfare. It's nothing to do with military. I think it's they compete in each other in the Middle East in terms of wealth and enterprises and business. I think they're trying to buy out clubs. Qatar bought PSG. United Arab Emirates bought Man City. And now you've got Suburb bought Newcastle. And I just feel like they're trying to buy clubs to compete each other and other businesses just to compete. If they don't get on the war field, they probably get on the business terms.
Well, I suppose Saudi Arabia's always had connections with English sport. I mean, I'm very, very connected with English racing. And is Sheikh Maktoum, is he from Saudi Arabia? I can't remember. Anyway, no. I can't think that there's anything more than the kudos of owning a Premier League football club. It's the best in the world.
I think it gives a element of legitimacy to them so that they get their foot through the door for other stuff. And I think if you look at football generally, it's quite a corrupt organisation, the way that it works from grassroots all the way up to the Premier League. You know, you look at the way Qatar got the World Cup and what's happened there. It's pretty despicable, to be perfectly honest. Right.
I'm an Arsenal fan, so... You know what I mean? You know, so I've got the Americans here. And do they care? No. You know? But they've got the money, innit? Do what they want. You know, money talks. Trust me. If Viola was... No, I don't know. I work for these lot, don't I? So I don't know.
The Premier League has allowed Middle Eastern dictatorships to purchase Manchester City Football Club and now Newcastle United Football Club. Why would they allow this to happen? And what is the Premier League getting out of these arrangements?
I guess it's about who has the money to buy something, really. I guess it's not about where you're from. It's just about what I couldn't buy a football club, for example. Maybe somebody else can buy a football club. Maybe they've got more to give to that, just because you're from somewhere else. I mean, I don't see the problem. I don't see the problem. Like, is it because people here wanted to buy the football club, but then it's priced at a higher price, so it's been sold overseas to somebody who can afford more? Is that the problem?
First thing that comes to mind would be money. You know, often a lot of these clubs and whatnot are quite greedy when it comes to money, and especially the people that have lots of money tend to want more money. And I feel like I can't see any other incentive other than just for the cash. That would be my opinion on that, yeah.
Do you know something? I've got to be honest here. Saudi Arabia, they could come in by Newcastle, but they ain't going to take money. You could buy all the best players in the world. Doesn't mean they're going to click. They could buy them next week. Are they going to click? Your manager's going to come in. He might not do well. 6 months down the road, sack him, we get someone else. They could be pear-shaped. Look at Arsenal. Since Arsene Wenger's left, right, they ain't sorted themselves out. Still struggling, you know, week in, week out. I'm a sad person because I'm an Arsenal fan. But money wouldn't help it. And I think they know that as well. They could pump in so much money into the club if they wanted to, but it's not going to do nothing. You know, you could buy all you want. It doesn't mean nothing. They could go next week in January sales and buy this player, that player, and that player. They might not click. And, you know, and the fans will turn on them, you know, turn on them again. You know, and they could walk out any time they want.
Injection of cash, of course. But how it will last, heaven knows. And, I mean, they had a tough enough run with, what was he called, the man who owned Sport Direct? Anyway, so they had a tough time with him. I mean, I think they're a very loyal fan base. They're called the Magpies, I think, aren't they? So, good luck, but I'd keep a very open mind on this.
Things have been pretty hopeless for a lot of these clubs, haven't they? You know, and I could see from the way that the Newcastle fans were celebrating that they're excited about it, and you know, somebody's putting a lot of money into their club, and it'll lift them and raise their stakes in the Premiership and make life more interesting. But you know, there's another side to it as well, isn't there? So,
That is what Newcastle wants, right? Newcastle wants to be a powerhouse again, and that's what it will become. You know, it might not be this season. Oh, it won't be this season. They might get relegated this season, but they will. They will build, and they will become like a. You know, they'll get a conversation at the table like Man City have.
I think it's very strict. It's not very strict for this kind of issues because they have to put some restrictions. For example, they can ask the source of money. And actually, I don't like the English Football Association's acts for this kind of issues.
I just think it's terms of generating revenue, innit? And the Middle East is very big on the Premier League, especially the world and globally as well. And if you cut off ties with a country due to the political reasons, they're going to cut off the funding and sponsorship, really. And I think FA, they're trying to allow that to happen, really. And I think they're there for the money.
The most recent takeover in the Premier League of Newcastle United comes after the controversial go-ahead was given for a consortium led by Saudi Arabia's State Sovereign Wealth Fund, known as the Public Investment Fund, or PIF, to take control of Newcastle United in this £300 million deal. Middle Eastern dictatorships have the money to invest vast sums on English football clubs. But with poor human rights records, this has created a dilemma that can't be resolved by simply pointing at Premier League success. However, it seems that according to the Premier League's ownership rules, when it comes to winning on investment or winning on human rights, the investment always comes first.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity. سيد عبد الله الموسوي.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at the justice from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salamullah. Now Amir al-Mu'mineen has been handed an opportunity to become the ruler and the Khalifa of the Muslims. He accepted another condition, that he serves the Muslims and he only applies justice to everybody. And he should be treated as one of them, and whatever applies to them applies to him. And they should give obedience to him, not to him personally, but to the fact that he is trying to serve them. And he said, I will be the first to do what I ask you to do, and I will be the first to refrain from that which I ask you to refrain. On the contrary, the object of the institution of Khilafah is that justice should be administrated. The ruler should mete out equal treatments to everybody and to everyone, and should regard the efforts of a person who propagates it, the divine religion, and the servants and serves the public, should prohibit hoarding, prevent oppression, and should not deviate from the truth in any circumstance. He should not abandon his program even though the wicked and cruel persons dislike his just conduct, and maybe after his life. It is also his duty to acquaint the people with the rules of justice and prevent their deviation from it. These are the things that need to apply when a person assumes office and assumes power. These are the things that Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he himself applied before anyone else. No one before him applied it. No one after him did. Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he wrote to one of his governors and he said, you are holding this office does not entitle you to accumulate wealth or take revenge from any person. Your only duty is that you should destroy falsehood and revive the truth. Simply put, Amir al-Mu'mineen is drawing the line to the governors, to those who are in power under his command, that this office holds nothing personal for you. All your personal interests, your desires, and wherever you feel like, it has to stay at home. This office is especially for the people, by the people, to serve the people, nothing else. Destroying falsehood or standing against falsehood means there should be no injustice in the power that you hold, in the office that you hold. And reviving the truth means you should apply everything that guarantees people a just, safe environment and a better living. So it does not in any way, shape or form entitles you to use it to accumulate wealth, which a lot of people do these days when they are in power, or to seek revenge on people because they cross them, because they have the power. This is something that should be eliminated from any office, from any position that has power over the people. No revenge whatsoever, and not to use your power to accumulate wealth at all. Let us take a short break, then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are still looking at the justice from the perspective of Amir al-Mu'mineen, Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi as-salam. Amir al-Mu'mineen, alayhi as-salam, in his eyes, that rulership and khilafah did not mean that the ruler should sit on the throne of dignity, strengthen his power, and make his position the means of enslaving the people. This is an absolute distorted meaning of rulership and khilafat that those before him did and those who are after him did as well. Well, they sit on the throne, they are dignified, they strengthen their power and enslave people. He said, generosity and munificence is a greater source of love and affection than consanguinity and kingship. There is no greater like meekness, nor virtue like knowledge. He is simply trying to state that power and rulership and taking position, it does not bring people or makes people to love you or have affection for you, but actually the opposite, being nice, being generous, being easygoing with people is what makes you lovable and makes you accepted amongst people. Arrogance is not the way to go. So being a leader, being a king, it doesn't mean that you're going to be loved by people or accepted by people, as we can see the case of those before him and those who were after him. That's never the case. What brings people together under the banner of a just ruler is how much love and compassion and generosity he has towards them. Now, we can also see this in our current moral world, where those rulers who are generous and kind to those who are around them, you see people love them, even if they don't give them their rights. They might give them just a portion of what they should be giving them, but yet you see people happy with them. Where if you look on the other side and you look at those who hoard everything and they take position and power and they become dictators, those are the most hated people around the world or across history in general. So Amir al-Mu'mineen, salamullah alayhi, when he dealt with the Muslims, not based on the fact that he's going to sit on the throne, not based on the fact that he's going to take power and enslave people, but in fact the opposite. It wasn't his personal gain or aim to strengthen his own power and increases his own wealth. On the contrary, it was him trying to serve the people as much as he can in any possible way he can. That was the mission and the objective of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam throughout the 4 years and 6 months he led the Muslims. His main concern was Muslims, Muslims, and Muslims. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa alihi. اللهم صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على
محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله صل على محمد وآله.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.